Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Many people are thinking about a young person who lost his life to cancer, you know, battling cancer four times. And the second time that this young man, Charlie Capalbo, who many of you know from Fairfield, got diagnosed a second time with cancer, it was his younger brother, Will, who decided to donate bone marrow. And you know, and I wanted to talk this morning, actually, a little bit about a donation of life, because actually April does mark Donate Life Month. And, you know, living organ donations are so imperative. They're so important. And there are actually facts and figures that 70% of patients who really need a donation, they need to find a match, their family members do not fully match. And that's where the giving of life is so it's so important. So this morning, I'm so glad to have Dr. Glenn Morgan on, a transplant surgery specialist, in fact, the chief of surgical transplantation at Hartford Hospital here this morning. Dr. Morgan, thank you so much for your time. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me, Melissa.
So first of all, talk to us, Dr. Morgan, on average, let's just talk about Connecticut, because I know it's much bigger nationally, but how many people are in need of some kind of a transplant per year? Any statistics you could share this morning?
Sure. Yeah, it's, there's a huge number of people on waiting lists around the country, and the waiting lists are divided based on the organ of need. So I'll just use liver transplantation as an example. Around the United States right now, there's nearly 20,000 people on waiting lists for liver transplantations. And we do about 9,000 transplants a year. So less than half of the people who are waiting will actually get an organ transplant, at least a liver transplant, in any given year. And that number is similar in heart transplantation. And it's about 2 to 3 times that for kidney transplantation. So the numbers are very large indeed.
How long on average does somebody wait on a list for a donation?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and it differs, again, depending on the organ, because kidney transplantation, for example, is very much dependent on how much time you have waited. And most people who are waiting a kidney transplant, for example, are on dialysis. And so that waiting time can be up to 4 or 5 years in areas like Connecticut. It can be even longer in some areas and shorter in other areas. So it does depend a little bit on the part of the country you're in, but it certainly depends on the amount of time you've been on dialysis. And that's different compared to other organs like liver transplantation or heart transplantation, because those organs are allocated not based on how much time you've waited, but how sick you are, or how sick your organ dysfunction has made you. And so the allocation there is based on need, not on time. So it's a little bit different. And it's an important distinction to make, too.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Morgan, I'm curious, is there a way that you can move up the list if you are on a waiting list and it's been a year or 2 years? Are there ways that patients can move up, like if you find out that your lifespan may be in jeopardy or something like that?
The best way, well, the greatest example there is for kidney transplantation, because if you can identify a living donor, someone who is willing to come forward and listen to the transplant team about the process of living donation, that can immediately give you control over the situation by allowing that donor to be evaluated and see if that person can donate for you right away. So that's the biggest single advantage that we have in getting transplants for people sooner. If you can identify a person, the transplant center can do that evaluation and education process. And the beauty of it now is you don't even have to have identified a match. That is all left up to us. And there are exchange programs all over the United States where kidneys in particular are moving back and forth across the country every single day, literally at this moment. So if you identify an individual, it might be a family member, it might be someone you didn't even know before, it might be an acquaintance, that person may not be a match for you, but it could be a match for a person, let's say, in Oklahoma. And there may be somebody in Georgia who is a match for you. And we are literally flying kidneys all over the United States doing transplants like that to get the most people off our list and get the help to the people who need it the most desperately.
Dr. Morgan is chief of surgical transplantation at Hartford Hospital. And this week, actually, I know it's donation month, Donate Life Month is April. But this week in particular is National Pediatric Transplant Week from April 24th to the 30th. I'm curious, Dr. Morgan, how does that work? If you have a child who needs a transplant, can you only find children organs, like child organs, if that makes sense? Or can an adult organ work for a child in need?
Yeah, no, excellent question. Yeah, it really, again, it all of this comes down to the organ itself. So, for example, in kidney transplantation, we definitely do prefer to have pediatric-sized organs. We can use slightly larger kidneys to fit into children. Again, it depends on the body size. But other organs, for example, liver transplantation, it's very common now to take parts of an adult liver and use them for a pediatric recipient. And whether that's through living donation or through donation through a deceased person, we do that routinely now. So you can sort of carve down a full-size adult organ to make it fit for a pediatric recipient. But again, you can do that for livers, very rarely done for lungs. But for kidneys and hearts, typically, of course, you need a whole organ that's a more appropriate size.
I'm sure many people, Dr. Morgan, are very familiar with the idea of when you get your license, you can put the option on your license that you want to be an organ donor. God forbid you get into some kind of a car wreck or a horrible disaster happens and you perish. You could check the license and see, oh, this person is an organ donor, and then get checked for that. But in general, other than that, who can donate their organs? Like, what does a qualified individual look like?
Right. It's an excellent point to raise, because the ability or the so-called permission to donate is very important. And signing the driver's license is certainly important. But it's one thing to sign it and just tuck it away in your wallet or your purse. It's really important to share your decision with the people who will left behind making that decision on your behalf. If they didn't know that you wanted that during your lifetime, it's going to be hard perhaps for them to make that decision. So there are also organ donor registries in every state in the country, where you can go online, you can sign up as an organ donor, and that immediately declares to the world that you are interested and willing, and it also has legal teeth, so to speak. So if people who are left behind didn't know what your wishes were, if they find that you are registered with an organ donor registry, then that gives the healthcare team the sort of the weight to come back to the family or the people, the friends, and say, look, this person wanted to do this. This was their intention. So we really want to, you know, be able to move forward with that. In terms of who, if pretty much any person, you know, there's very few reasons why we would not take an organ donor. Advanced cancer, metastatic cancer that caused the death would be one reason. But in this day and age, there are almost always some tissue gift or organ gift that we are able to use. And it doesn't have to be a solid organ like a heart, a liver, a lung, or a kidney. It could be tissue. It could be valves. It could be cartilage. It could be there are all sorts of other tissues that can be procured from the body to use for people in need. So pretty much anybody should be considered. And hospitals are obligated to notify agencies when a quote eligible death has occurred, and so this is something that's very well worked out. So pretty much anybody, I guess, is the right answer, Melissa.
According to national data, as of 2021, 169 million people in the U.S. registered as donors, but not everyone who registers as a donor can actually donate. In fact, only 3 in 1,000 people die in a way that allows for deceased organ donation, which is why we have months like April where we bring attention to donating life. And, you know, on that note, Dr. Morgan is here this morning, chief of surgical transplantation at Hartford Hospital. A question, is there an age limit to when you can donate? So let's say you are somebody in your 80s, you have it on your license, everybody in your family knows, yep, she wants to donate her organs, he wants to donate his organs. Is there like an age limit that, you know what, sorry, like these organs just are basically too old, essentially? Have they been on this earth for too long, or can they still be used for a young person?
Yeah, that's an excellent question as well. Again, it does depend a little bit on how healthy that person was. So there is no absolute age cutoff. We have used livers in individuals in their 80s, even early 80s. Kidneys certainly the same way. But it depends on the health of the person, and more specifically, the health of the organ more specifically. So that's really the key. So no absolute age cutoff. You did allude to it in your preamble about how you die, because the important thing for organ donation from deceased individuals is that the heart still needs to be beating, and we need to be able to have an established declaration of brain death, which means the person has died in a legal way. In this country, we have a legal definition of brain death, but since the heart is beating and there's a good blood pressure, the vital organs can be maintained in a healthy condition until such time as organ procurement can occur. So that's really the key. It's identifying the person, not so much in the way they died, but in the timeliness of the death and whether they were able to get to a healthcare institution in an intensive care unit so they can be resuscitated to maintain blood flow to these vital organs. And that's really the single most important thing for deceased donors. Obviously, living donors is a completely different topic and really, really important for us in the field of transplantation.
Oh, it's funny you say that, Dr. Morgan. That was going to be my next question. Can you talk about the difference between a cadaver organ, a living organ, someone who died and donates versus someone who is living?
Sure. Again, living donation, and I'll use kidney transplantation because it's far and away the most likely scenario where we use living donors. Living donation is a true gift. It's a gift that, you know, relatively few can comprehend unless you're actually in the situation. But it's a tremendous benefit, not only to the recipient, but in ways to the donor as well. So the advantages in kidney transplantation are several. The main one, of course, is that you know exactly when your donation is going to be. You have control of the situation. You do not have to be on a waiting list for years. And as I said before, you know, the average waiting for a kidney now in this area of the country is about 5 years. And so you can immediately identify that person, have the testing done, and go for the transplant. So this can, you know, theoretically all happen within a matter of weeks or months. And kidneys from live donors tend to work better. They tend to last longer. So there's a double advantage there. So you can certainly not only get control of your organ transplant situation, which is really important when you're dealing with all these the things that having end-stage organ disease can lead to, but it gives you ultimately a better quality organ that will hopefully last longer.
And Dr. Morgan is here this morning, Chief of Surgical Transplantation at Hartford Hospital. Now, I know here in our listening area, we have St. Vincent's Medical Center, and they have a transplant clinic. So they can't actually do the transplant surgeries, but I know you head up that transplant clinic. What exactly is it? What's the goal? What is the work that's being done there?
Right. Yeah, thank you. So Hartford Healthcare has been, we want to reach as many people throughout the state as possible. And with our partnership with St. Vincent, we thought it was really important to have a footprint in Fairfield County. And so we started this clinic about a year ago. And this is a clinic for people with kidney failure, and soon we'll be branching out into people with liver failure as well. People who want to be evaluated for transplantation, people who have had transplants and will need follow-up closer to their homes in Fairfield County. And that's really the focus of the clinic. So they don't have to come to Hartford each time for a checkup that might only be 15 or 20 minutes. Now, the actual surgeries that we do, of course, are done in Hartford at Hartford Hospital. But the advantage to the clinic and the proximity to patients in Fairfield County is huge. And so we're there every week. I personally go there as well. I see patients who are trying to get on kidney transplant lists, patients who are waiting for kidneys, and patients who are in the follow-up phase who've already had their transplant and are just coming for their post-operative checkups and follow-up visits. So it's a real advantage in terms of convenience, and I think truly increases you know, the patient experience, not having to travel so long for what could be a relatively simple appointment.
Dr. Morgan, I appreciate you giving us so much time this morning. If people want to even just ask more questions, they want to learn more about donating life, maybe they themselves are considering being a donor, what are their next steps? What would you recommend?
So the first thing is learning, getting educated about the process. particularly if you're obviously, you know, for people that are listening now, we're talking about living donation. Everybody, as we talked about before, should register as an organ donor. That's an extremely important step you can make. And learn about living donation. If there's anybody that you know, it certainly doesn't have to be a family member. I think there's the sense that it needs to be family, you need to be biologically related, and that's not true at all. In fact, most of our transplants now are from people that are not biologically related to the recipient. So educating yourself, you can go to our website at the Hartford Hospital Transplant Center and read about the process and just inform yourself. And that simple task will you know, really reap benefits for the future in huge ways that will, you know, benefit the recipients and, you know, ensure that you can give the gift of life if the situation should arise.
Dr. Morgan, Chief of Surgical Transplantation at Hartford Hospital and also in charge of the St. Vincent's Medical Center Transplant Clinic, we thank you so much for your time this morning, and thanks for making it a part of WICC. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Melissa. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Good morning. This question just cracks me up. What do you do when you mess up? I'm just going to get right into it. Joining me now is our marriage consultant, Bob Donovan. He's here every other week. He tries to fix our relationships. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I don't know about fixing things.
No, you
maybe,
do.
Maybe having people think about them.
Nope. You fix things. I already got an email this morning and said, oh, good. Make sure Bob gives his email again because I need them for a family friend of mine. I'm telling you, you fix things. It's okay, Bob. You fixed us. At least I know for a fact you fixed one couple, okay? You fixed one. That was me and Derek. So you fix her. You're like a fixer-upper.
Okay.
How are you?
Good. Really good.
So I love this topic because, let's be honest, all couples mess up, right? We all mess up from time to time. But you're kind of focusing on the key is not to mess up. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, I guess the first of all is that what I'm not talking about is something massive, like a marriage crisis mess up. Like we talked about that a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that. This is like, you know, daily stuff, you know, two imperfect people managing life, dealing with work stress, kids stress, all that. You put them together and it doesn't always go perfectly. So
it
just
can't.
Trying to be real here, right?
Right.
It can't, right. It's impossible. So people actually think that is they're a little idealistic. So, and, you know, I'm just, for me personally, this became, which I'll get into later, this became kind of fresh. So I thought, might be something worth talking about. So that's kind of what I mean. And again, I'm just trying to be real with couples dealing with life, respond differently, not appropriately, negatively, whatever. So I want to talk about what things, maybe things not to do,
mm-hmm.
and things what to do, and then maybe a real life lesson from someone.
Okay. I was going to say, I know you're kind of like holding out, but I sort of want you to spill the tea. What do you mean this became fresh for you? What are you talking about? Did you mess up?
You
mess up? You did? Bob
yes.
Donovan!
Yes.
What?
Yes, I did.
What do you
I
mean?
Did. In fact,
what'd
when
you
I
do?
Was. Well, let's hold that to the end, all right?
Oh,
let's hold
wow.
That to the end.
It was really that bad? Okay,
yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
A little teaser.
All
yeah.
right. All right. Hey, listen to you. Look at you being so good at radio, trying to keep people engaged for 10 plus minutes. Look at you, Bob Donovan. Proud of you, friend. All right, fine. Then we'll go by what you're saying. We'll find out the juicy part of this interview coming up. But what
right.
not to do? Let's start with that. What do you mean by what not to do?
Yeah. And we've talked about a few of these things, but again, in the context of this here, you know, just a really, really bad thing to do with a couple is leading with your emotions. I talk about that. I love this term. Your emotions shouldn't be the engine. They should be the caboose. And so often, especially in a stress situation, when you say something or you're frustrated or whatever, a little angry, then
mm-hmm.
you respond inappropriately. So often in a conflict, you respond with a negative way to process your emotions. Rather than
mm-hmm.
you know, reflect on your emotions, you kind of lead with, you know, anger or frustration, and that's just not a healthy thing to do. So, you know, again, for people that are more emotional, like my wife and I tend to be more introverted, more measured, but not everybody's like that. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I know you tend to be a little more emotional. So, you know, you're actually more normal with couples. So leading with your emotions and responding out of emotion usually doesn't go well, usually.
It's interesting you say it, Bob, because my biggest pet peeve is when people say,
to be honest. And then they say, but I don't want it's that's not meant to hurt you. And I think to myself, you did not think about what you're saying. Like, that's something you'll right. really never hear me say when I'm having an argument in whether it's my marriage or whether it's with a friend. You're right, I'm an emotional person. But if I'm hurt by something, it takes me about 3 days to process something before I approach you. I am that person that will say, and my producer can actually attest to this, I will say, I can't talk to you about this right now because I don't want to hit below the belt. I need some time. I need a hot second. I will come back to you at whatever point, because it drives me nuts when people are not, like, they don't take the time to just think through what they're about to say or how they're about to feel, and take into account that it's like you're talking to somebody you love or you're supposed to love. So just, it's fine to have emotions, but how you actually present them, I think, matters so much.
Well, that's totally right. And actually, I love what you say. Unfortunately, that's not the case with a lot of couples, that typically in the midst of a conflict, you know, they are, again, one of them, typically one couple is more emotional and they lead with that. They respond. And the other one shuts down.
Yes. Yes. that's my marriage. Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
That's my marriage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's most men do this, and not to overgeneralize, but that's what most men. So that's another one I said, you know, don't walk away. Don't isolate. In the middle of this, that's another, you know, thing that you don't do. So, you know, and again, these are natural responses.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is a little, I really love it, because it is not natural. Like, just to reflect, take a time out, walk away, say, I know I'm going to say something inappropriate. Give me a day or two to respond. That's not common. So I love it. But this is one thing couples be a little bit aware of, what not to do.
Well, and we're talking this morning to Bob Donovan, our marriage consultant. But I think, Bob, when you do it enough times, like, I mean, after 14 years of being with the same person, you know, the other approach doesn't work so well. You know, you do become very hurtful. And those are things that you can't take back. Like, there are words I have said that I cannot take back. My husband, thank God, is very forgiving and he's very graceful. But there are things that I have said that I think to myself, man, if I had just given myself a day or two to just process, I wouldn't have even gone there. There was no need to go there over something as silly as blah, 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 blah. So I just, you would hope enough times that people, if you are on, like, me, who's emotional, that you wouldn't keep doing that, because at some point it is going to burn a bridge. I think, I don't know. That's just me.
You're totally right. Because often, if this was repeated over and over again, I mean, the outcome of that is you just build up resentment.
He would have been like, bye, I'm done with you.
Right.
I'm pretty sure.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yep. I'll tell you another thing I see that really makes me crazy, and I've seen this with a couples recently, that they take the responsibility for how they feel. Like, if they're angry and they lash out or something, or they even respond negatively, or even withdraw, like, whatever, it's a negative response. Mm. They blame the other person.
And
I got to an argument with this guy because he was convinced his wife made him angry. Like, almost like, you know what? I have no control over this. She knows which buttons to push. She pushes them and I respond. I have no control. Like, I'm looking at him like, really? Like, you have no control.
You've got
over
this,
how
sir.
You respond to
I know
emotion.
You can. Right, right.
Wow, wow. Yeah, so anyway, that's another thing to be
blame
careful
game.
Of.
Blame game,
yeah. Being the victim, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he or she made me do this.
Right, right. That's a good one. I will hear this one, too, when you generalize things. You know, I'm always the person who does this. You never do this. And I think to myself, I don't know. That used to drive me nuts when I was growing up, because I used to hate being told that. So I hate being told, not by like a spouse, but like by whether it's a boss or whether it was a teacher or a friend, you know, you're always this. And I'm like, wow, that's impressive. I'm always that. That's amazing. I'm always like that. That's amazing. You know, that drives me nuts.
I've seen couples, and I don't know if it's they're going to more therapy these days, but I've seen couples really do better at that. I see them really, in fact, if they say it, they catch themselves and say, you know, rarely, or they'll use another term. So I do see couples improving with that. What I don't see is like the follow on, which is you're this, like, you know, you're irresponsible. You're spend money unwise, like a judgment statement. I see that a little bit. So, you know, all this is just responding kind of inappropriately in the heat of the moment, which couples got to be a little bit more, you know, measured about. We'll talk about how to handle this in a little bit, but that's you know, those are some things a couple should try to avoid.
You know, we look at national data all the time, and it does show that we're on the decline for divorces. And it might be because of people like Bob Donovan, who do excellent work in our community trying to help make healthier relationships. But we are also noticing less and less people are getting married as well. So we feel very strongly every couple of weeks to have somebody come on to just help us make healthier decisions in our relationships, whether it is your spouse, your partner, your very dear friend, a companion, your husband, your wife, whoever it may be. We want to help you, you know, to overcome just minor challenges. And this week, especially, we're talking about what do you do when you mess up? We're talking about minor things, you know, nothing that takes weeks and weeks of therapy. But, you know, just it's going to happen. You're going to have moments. And Bob's going to share one actually in just a couple of minutes. But Bob, let's talk about the second part of this, which is what should you try to do? So we talked about what you shouldn't do, like isolating yourself, letting your emotions get the best of you. But what are things that you should try to do when there's conflict?
Yeah, I think, and I just there could be a lot, but I'm going to just focus on three. And these three are pretty powerful. Couples practice them. And the first really is kind of to self-examine before you cross-examine. And with any conflict, right, there is, even if it's minimal, there is some contribution mm-hmm. from each spouse. Even if it's 10% or 20%, right, there's some contribution. Mm-hmm. So where this goes crazy in the crazy cycle is you start looking at what he or she did or didn't do, okay? And this changes when you start looking at your part of it and you take ownership for your – this is the opposite of the victim game, the blame game. This is now taking ownership for your part, mm-hmm. whatever that is. That would be an enormous step forward if couples started to doing that. Mm-hmm. You mentioned what you do, that you kind of can step away and come back to it, and that's just great. A lot of couples don't do that. But when you take ownership for just your piece, even if it's small, just your piece, it changes the dynamics of everything. When you're able to pause and reflect on what's going on, even looking at possibly what triggered you, you know, why you became so frustrated or angry. So, you know, looking at your part before you focus on your spouse is a huge first step in resolving. And that's your goal, is to resolve the conflict.
Sure.
You know, I said earlier, the goal isn't here to not mess up. It's to mess up less frequent mm-hmm. as you grow in your marriage. That's the
right.
goal.
So, and to learn to kind of roll with like not sweat the small stuff. You know, if you mess up often, which is just going to happen, that's the reality. You're human. It's not your fault. But I think if you can learn with grace how to handle mess ups a little bit better every time, it's not going to feel like World War III every time you have a disagreement or something.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's a great lesson in just marriage, because as you go on, once you believe your spouse is there for you, it's not going to leave, it's not going to judge or criticize. Once you believe that, then you start letting go of the little things. It's maybe the things that would bother you in the first couple of years bother you less later on. So
sure.
Learning to let go, that's another good tip. Okay, the second one is just like a sports team, right? In sports, with any game, whether it's basketball, hockey, whatever game, you're always focused on how many timeouts do I have left and how to use them. Huh. And this would be a major tool with a couple. Again, for one spouse tends to be a little bit more emotional, a little more high-strung. If that one spouse can learn how to use timeout, take a breather, even if it's for 15 minutes, that would be an enormous step in resolving conflict. And I'll tell you a crazy story. There was a period where Karen and I were talking to a bunch of couples, I don't know, about a year ago maybe, and we're talking about this, using timeouts, and we basically asked for, like, a code word, like you can use T-O or whatever, but a code word. So this first couple talks about their code word was pineapple. I said, that's pretty cool, right? And I'm not exaggerating. Like, weeks later, another couple, totally unrelated, tells us the exact same code word that they use. That's right. A month later, a third couple comes in. They're describing this, and I talked about this code word and everything. And they looked at me, and I said, "Hold on, don't tell me your word is pineapple." And they agreed. I mean, it's just crazy.
I'm wondering if it's because pineapples stand for home, welcome, comfort. I'm pretty sure pineapples stand for only because my mom has pineapples all over her house. I'm pretty sure it's like, you know, warm welcome, open house, comfort. So I'm wondering if that's why. That's funny. Fruit in general, like I know, I mean, there's a fruit that we use for, you know, codes and things if like our alarm goes off and whatever. And I don't know. There's something about fruits for people. I don't know. People are weird.
This was stunning. This was stunning.
That's funny. Yeah. That is
really
funny.
So let me get real here, right? So, you know, I'm like, you call me the marriage consultant, the expert or whatever, and our church people look at us that way. And,
what'd you do?
You know, we're gonna be on our 47th anniversary in a few weeks, right? So I got it. I do all this, right? Right? Not so.
What'd you do? What'd you do, Bob?
My wife and I are involved with something a little complicated, and it's causing a little stress. I can tell you're taking it to the radio.
I can tell you're involved, right?
So it was last week. I came home and something happened, and I was driving home, and out of 20-30 minutes in the car, and you know, I'm just building it up. I'm ruminating on it. It's becoming bigger and bigger, mm-hmm. and this is a little later in the evening, so we kind of wind down later in the evening. So I literally came in the door and like just boom,
guns blazing,
and not Karen, like she had nothing to do with it. It was just me, like
no, you were hyped up about what just happened.
Exactly right, and it's just totally the wrong thing to do. It kind of like upset her, and she got a little wound up, and then we're going back and forth, and I started trying to defend like what I did, and then she says, she's great, she goes, Bob, it's not what you did, it's how you did it.
Mm.
And I, okay, and you know what? The funny thing is, like I knew it. It's
it
later in the night.
Yeah.
I knew it. You know, we tend to wind down. I know she has trouble sleeping. She used to wind down, and I came in and kind of wound everything up, and I knew it. And it, at that point in time, like my need to share something was more important than being sensitive to what she needed, which was there was no reason why I couldn't wait till the morning. No reason. So, you know, she all wound up, and I did too. And then, so what did I do? Right? What did I do?
Well, I reached
out. I apologized. I hugged her. And I just prayed. I just prayed for about 3 or 4 minutes just for God's peace to come over her and me. And I apologized, took ownership for this. And just really, I think it really did diffuse the situation by just like admitting it, owning it, apologizing, and then really praying for her and for us in that moment. It worked out great because she had actually had a great night's sleep. So,
there you go.
But, you know, like I just had to laugh because I could think about this topic. I said, yeah, I got to talk about this. Because even Bob, you know,
right.
The,
even
marriage
perfect
expert,
Bob,
47
right.
year marriage.
Right.
It does couples mess up.
Mm-hmm. No, but I appreciate you being so honest about it, Bob, because I do think it speaks volumes. You know, that's exactly it, I think. And it goes back to the very first point we made in the top of this, which was you said the goal here is not to not mess up, because if you can continue to work, you know, through it and it's not so hard, you know, then 47 years later, you will still be married to the person you love and you're still going to mess up. But it's going to be
that's
okay.
Right.
It's going to be okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And realizing, I guess, like I said, it just struck me like I needed, my need to do something was more important than her need. That's what it really comes down to. And then just to be sure, the next morning I got up and I apologized again.
We always got to be sure. Yeah, we got to cover all our bases. I totally hear you on that. Bob, I'm curious, can you just share your email for folks who want to connect with you and talk more about this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, that would be great. I'd love that. It's B Donovan, DONOVAN, at blackrock.org.
All right. Well, I so appreciate having you on, Bob, and I'm glad that you're out of the doghouse. You're doing good. You and Karen are the best. Love you guys so much.
Okay. You too.
I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
The latest from the state capitol about your own neighborhood. Connecticut Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff stops by Melissa in the morning. Now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Duff. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Good morning. It's Monday. Here we are.
Here we go. Here we go. Another day. Another day, another dollar. I have a quick question for you. Well, I don't know how quick it'll be. We'll see. So I know the state.
Your questions are never quick.
Hey! Hey! Anyway. Wow! Shots fired on a Monday, Senator Duff. Jeez, tell us how you really feel. No, I just had a quick question. Yeah, right? So, okay, I wanted to talk about the Senate possibly taking up a bill this week allowing Tesla to market the company's electric vehicles directly to the public. My quick question was going to be, can you explain why? I know this has been proposed and rejected for a very long time. What's sort of the deal with this for people who are confused as to why Tesla can't directly market their luxury vehicles to the public? Why is that?
Well, I think there's, you know, there's been a lot of debate about it over the years. I introduced legislation many years ago to allow. It's not just Tesla, so let's just kind of clear that up first. It's direct sales of vehicles and electric vehicles. There's more than just Tesla. There's other companies that also have electric vehicles as well. But there's been, you know, significant pushback by the dealerships about doing direct sales, because of the fact that there's been a model in place with dealerships since the 1950s. And this would upend that. I think there's a legitimate question about service and servicing vehicles and how that would work, and the fact that there's been a dealership model in place for a very long time. So there's, you know, that's been the debate, and whether or not direct sales is appropriate or not for the state. And but there's still been quite a bit of interest by many folks about having direct sales, and I think something like this that takes a that kind of is disruptive to the marketplace. It takes a long time to try and figure out and sort out whether or not this is the right thing or not the right thing to do for our state.
What do you think?
Like I said, I've supported and I've introduced legislation in the past to allow direct sales in the state of Connecticut. And it's always been very dicey whether or not we have the votes. So I think we're still counting the votes on this bill in the state Senate. I don't know if the votes are there or not in the House. That's not saying that they're not there. I just don't know. But I know that there are folks who are working hard on it and who believe in the legislation pretty firmly.
Okay. And we know the legislative session, hard to believe, is going to be done next week. I can't believe we're already into May.
Right, exactly. And that's part of the calculus as well, is that there's a lot of bills to do, and there's very little time to do it in. And that, we have a tradition in the state legislature where we don't limit debate on bills, so that people can have the time to talk on both sides of the aisle. That's unlike, I think, a lot of other legislatures around the country. And so, there's only so much we can get done in between now and midnight at May 4th. So we have to be careful about scheduling. So we have to make sure we have the votes before we bring up this item or any other item that may be a talker.
Are there anything, we're talking to Senator Duff this morning, any of the items still on the table, Senator Duff, that you're hoping either just gets addressed, let alone just passes by the end of May 4th?
Well, I think there's a number of different bills that we have. The Senate Democratic Caucus has bills that are still priority bills for us, priority caucus bills. Last week, we were able to get done the data privacy bill, which is great. We also were able to get done Senate Bill 2, which talked a lot about early childhood and mental health. We still have Senate Bill 1, which deals a lot with educational issues. Senate Bill 4, which is our version of the Clean Air Act. We have Senate Bill 5, which talks about online harassment and online safety. So we still have to get those done. We still have the House Bill 5001. We have to do when the House passes that. We've got to do earlier this week, a bill that still allows remote voting. Remote meetings that a lot of the towns are asking for that to be done, because that sunsets on April 30th. And, you know, there's the small thing of a budget and, other bills as well. Some are big, some are small. So, when you kind of put all those into place, and timing-wise, there's not a whole lot of time left. So that's why we've got to make sure that we use the time wisely, and we make sure that we have bills that have the votes and can get it through. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of interest in the direct sales this year. And there's, it's clean air, and we see that a lot of, you know, even traditional companies, GM and Ford and others are going to all electric in a not too distant future. So it's just not specific to one company on how they the kind of cars that they have. Most cars will probably be electric over the next 10 years or so.
And I know another thing that is being discussed, I think potentially up for a vote today with just the committee, is the bill looking at how police notify next of kin after what happened in Bridgeport, the two women who died the same night, different incidents, but same night in December. And both families were never notified. And Mayor Ganim came right out and said that the police failed to notify these two families. That bill, as I mentioned, that's still up for debate just for the Public Safety Committee. If we run out of time, essentially, we get to May 4th, when would be the next time that would be up for discussion or anything that doesn't get done in this session?
Yeah, that is an important bill for sure, and I hope that gets through the House so we can get it through the Senate, obviously. But when it's May 4th for every other bill that's out there that doesn't make it either past the House or the Senate or both chambers, you have to start all over again in January when we go back into session.
Okay. Yep. So for anybody who wasn't aware, the next time that they're in session will be January of 2023. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Senator Duff, I appreciate it. And I know next week we're going into our final week, so we certainly will see what comes up between now and then. And I look forward to chatting with you.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator Duff. I think my questions were pretty prompt today. I think they were pretty quick.
They were fine. They were fine. They were very good, as usual.
Senator Duff, appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We'll talk again next week. That's Senator Duff here on WICC. We like to have a little fun. It's okay, guys. It's a Monday morning.
What's going on in the Capitol and how it affects you? State Senator Tony Wong joins Melissa in the morning right now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Good morning, Senator Wong. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I am great. Good morning, Melissa. And it was great to see you this weekend.
Oh, I know. It was fun.
Yeah, the Family Justice Center event, walking a mile in her shoes. I wore Crocs, not heels. But it was to raise awareness against domestic violence. And what a great weekend. It was so nice to see people out and about and just really being joyous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. It was amazing after 2 years of it being virtual that we got to have it back in person. It was telling. There were hundreds of people. It was amazing, really amazing.
Well, we're hopefully going forward with a new normal with caution, obviously with COVID. But I also was able to officiate the opening of the Fairfield Women's Little League softball, and there must have been about 500 people out there celebrating a new softball season and teams out there. It really is a fantastic opportunity to remind ourselves that we're so lucky to be able to live in this area and to be able to finally celebrate being together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't said it better myself. I agree with you. Senator Wong, a few minutes ago I had Senator Duff on, and I just really, we're getting down to the wire. Next week is the end of the legislative session, and I know we're not going to be back in session until January of next year. So I wanted to hear from you. What are some of the biggest conversations or the top bills right now that you feel are still on the table, you'd like to see have more conversation about or for them to get passed? Or to get rejected, I'll even say that, before the end of the session next week. Could you maybe narrow it down to a couple that you have your eye
sure,
on?
Sure, happily. I think first and foremost is addressing the mental health crisis that we're encountering. Senate Bill 2, which I was very proud to work on, address youth mental health and behavioral services. It's one of three major mental health bills, and we were able to address some of the cost issues. But most important of all, it is raising awareness that COVID may have exacerbated and raised a greater awareness of mental health. But we've always had those critical, important issues. And one of the positives I'm hopeful is COVID and the incredible crisis we had will bring forth real solutions. So Senate Bill 2, which was comprehensive in addressing a lot of the components of mental health, was passed in a truly bipartisan basis in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll now move to the House to get passage. But it is important. The mental health issue is critical. And what I said on the floor speech was this. It is critical, but we need to give credit and a testament to these parents and caregivers and grandparents who spoke out on the challenges that our young kids have endured in regards to school dynamics and masking dynamics. I wanted to personally point out that it was their passion, their advocacy for their kids that really kind of guided us and
mm-hmm.
shared with us what was necessary. So kudos to them for stepping up and really against all initial tides, really fighting for their kids, and God bless them for that.
So, Senator Wong, if Senate bill, if the bill passes, which it sounds like it has strong bipartisan support, which is great, what exactly does that mean for mental health in Connecticut?
Well, it looks at our schools in regards to services that are provided and you know, school-based health centers. We also looked at providers that we have a dramatic shortage of. We also looked at some of the components in regards to services, being able to make sure that our state agencies as well as our critical nonprofits are available. There are other component bills that looks at school-based specifically, but there are other aspects of mental health. And as a co-ranking on insurance, mental health coverage of parity in our insurance is critical as well. So for those people that want to find out more, Senate Bill 2, they can go to the legislative website. It's cga.ct.gov, and they can just type in on the bottom bill number, number 2.
Okay.
And it will be comprehensive. And the other critical area is the budget, Melissa.
Oh, sure.
We're a two-year budget that was passed last year. And in an off-budget year, we make corrections or adjustments based upon unforeseen changes. One of the problems is the fact that we have a surplus due to using ARPA money and this strong stock market and some of the components we put in a bipartisan basis 5 years ago. So we've got a lot of money flowing around. We got a rainy day fund, and we are looking to try to maintain this budget. Right now, we don't have to do a single thing with the budget. The budget's balanced, it's effective, but there are many advocates that are saying we need to do more. We need to be able to utilize and create programs. And that's where we're getting into a challenge. The budget is a massive program. It impacts all aspects of our lives. But ultimately, we have to also look at it from a stewardship, fiscal responsibility stewardship, is any program that we now add into, for example, the mental health program, it is important, it is critical, but nevertheless, we need to be conscious that any program that we implement needs to be viable, sustainable, and financially viable moving into the forward. Because when we lose the ARPA money and we don't have the rainy day fund, you know who's going to supplement that? The taxpayers of Connecticut. The third critical issue that is not on a legislative agenda, Melissa, is concern about consumers. Our residents, inflationary costs, the burden of challenges of how they are able to cope. We reduce gasoline taxes for just 3 months. We have food prices that are skyrocketing. I just paid $5 for a slice of pizza. You talk about inflation. I can't live without pizza, but $5 for a slice.
That's a lot. Everything is. Just, right.
Everything is so expensive and costly that we need to have tax relief to help people be able to withstand the challenges of economic challenges.
So that
and ultimately.
So that's what I was going to say. So the tax cut proposal from the GOP, that kind of ties into the budget?
Absolutely, because at the end of the day, we make piecemeal reductions, which are important. But look, the state of Connecticut actually benefits from inflationary costs because at our tax, sales tax increase, as prices of the product goes up, the state is getting a greater portion of the sales tax income. So our suggestion, the Senate Republican suggestion, is look at a comprehensive tax cut to ease the burden. But also, we have to look at the last thing I will say that's not on legislative. We got a plethora of other bills, but it doesn't get a lot of the attention. We still need to support our local small businesses in the state of Connecticut. They are struggling still post this pandemic, and they are still trying to adapt to this marketplace. So ultimately, there's so many things that we can do. There are bills that get the attention, but there's so many other bills that well-intentioned legislators are trying to implement, and I hope that gets through as well. Mm-hmm. But it is all about representing the people, and the key is sometimes there's a real disconnect what is a priority to Hartford as politicos versus the people down on Main Street.
Mm. Senator Huang, we really appreciate having you on. And as I mentioned, hard to believe we're down to just a mere couple of weeks before the legislative session comes to a close next week. So we appreciate you coming on, talking to us about some of the key items, and we'll talk again next week.
Thank you very much. And please, if I'm allowed a second to say my thoughts and prayers to the Capelbo family. Charlie was so special and so inspirational. I'm deeply saddened that, mm-hmm. that we have lost him.
I feel the same way. Mm-hmm.
And thank you for the opportunity to be able to give my thoughts to them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I thought your quote was beautiful this morning. Your statement was beautiful. And I too hope that he's not feeling, you know, pain and suffering anymore. And he had a long battle, 4 bouts of cancer. So just an extraordinary young man. And I know he's in a better place, but it's all of us on Earth who then miss him, you know?
Well,
so,
I think it's important. He has taught us a message that we can never, ever relax and stop supporting those that are struggling with cancer or illnesses, that it matters to care and to be engaged. But I just wanted to leave by saying the unconditional sacrifices and love that Jenny and Anthony, their parents, and Will, his brother, who gave bone marrow, you know what, they were remarkable. I mean, their love was so unconditional, and it's so unfathomable. It really brings, I'm heartbroken, but I'm also grateful to have been inspired by such a remarkable young man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't have put it better myself. Senator Tony Huang, we so appreciate you coming on and sharing those words. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right. State Senator Tony Huang here on WICC.